Online all the time at southernfm.com.au.
Welcome to the Space Show.
I'm Apollo 16 astronaut Charlie Duke, the 10th man to walk on the moon. And you got a bunch of guys about to turn blue. This is the Space Show, Australia, on 88.3 Southern FM.
Last Friday was an exciting one for the engineers at La Trobe University. They were about to turn blue, just like Charlie Duke. Years of effort was about to come to fruition. There was a sense of both apprehension and anticipation as they and their friends gathered at the headquarters of Engineers Australia in Bourke Street. Hello, this is the Space Show with Andrew Rennie. A hyperspectral camera called DESIS sat atop a Falcon 9 rocket half a world away at Cape Canaveral. The pants and size of the rocket reminded all present that rocketry is a dangerous business. A hyperspectral camera takes the sunlight reflected off the Earth below and splits it into hundreds of colours. This is much like raindrops or a prism separating sunlight into a spectrum of colour. A rainbow, if you will. Data from each colour detected is transmitted to scientists on the ground. With the assistance of computers, selected colours are used to identify vegetation types. Hyperspectral cameras are complex things and take years to develop. In this case, the engineers at La Trobe University teamed up with the German space agency known by the acronym DLR. Together, they developed DESIS, that's D-E-S-I-S, the DLR Earth Sensing Imaging Spectrometer. Some space instruments take decades to develop. The German and Australian team took only 3 years to design and build this revolutionary camera. Now it was less than an hour away from being thrust into space by that Falcon 9 rocket en route to the International Space Station. We join the gathering at Engineers Australia as La Trobe University's Department of Engineering team leader, Dr. Peter Moore, developed who helped develop the instrument, welcomed guests to this celebratory event.
So my name is Peter Moore from the Department of Engineering at La Trobe University. I'm also chair of Engineers Australia National Committee for Space Engineering. So it's a very exciting night for us, and I'd like to just welcome a few key speakers that we have tonight. Firstly, Dr. Amanda Caples from the Victoria Government, our lead scientist. Professor Alan Duffy from Swinburne University, also lead scientist of the Royal Institution of Australia. Welcome to all members of Space Association of Australia, members of the Space Industry Association of Australia, Engineers Australia members, and of course a big welcome and congratulations to our Tiger Radar team, who will shortly all be here in person. Also, I just need to note that this is being recorded both by our Media and Comms Department at La Trobe University, and also it'll be recorded to be played on radio on the Space Show at Southern FM. So this will be rebroadcast. So thank you for coming. As we speak, there is a payload that's going to go to the International Space Station. It'll be launched at 7:41 our time, 4:41 at the Kennedy Space Center in Florida. So 3 years of our work, probably 5 years from the DLR, from when they first came up with the idea to create this instrument, is culminating in this launch tonight. So it wasn't until around about 2:30 this afternoon that I realised the importance of this event tonight, and I started getting really nervous. And I really don't know how I'm going to feel 10 minutes, 5 minutes, 1 minute out from launch. We've got a late entrant. in tonight's schedule. We'll be crossing live via Skype. Warwick Holmes will be at Sydney University in Sydney. Warwick Holmes is probably our most experienced avionics engineer that Australia has ever produced. He has worked for ESA for 30 years and placed about 37 tonnes worth of equipment into orbit. So we'll be asking him what actually happens in the last half hour, hour, and so forth. And I think you're going to find it's quite dramatic to know what happens behind the scenes. So we'll be talking to him later in the evening. But without further ado, I'd like to introduce our next presenter, although it'll be a fireside chat, is Associate Professor Alan Duffy, who is an astrophysicist at Swinburne University and lead scientist of the Royal Institution of Australia. His research involves creating baby universes on supercomputers to understand how galaxies like our Milky Way form and grow within vast halos of invisible dark matter. No doubt we could talk for hours on that. He then tries to find this dark matter as a part of the SABRE project, the world's first dark matter detector in the southern hemisphere at the bottom of a gold mine. Where is that gold mine?
Stall.
Sorry?
Stall.
Stall, okay. We're not exploring simulated universes. You can find him explaining science in this one on ABC Breakfast TV, Catalyst, and TENS, the project. So I've asked Alan to come along to have a discussion with him to talk about his experience being live at a launch venue, but also some information he may have in relation to our space agency and where Australia may be headed. So if we can just give Alan a round of applause, and we'll just take a seat over here and we'll start a discussion. So thanks for coming, Alan. Most appreciated. So my first question for you is, I've seen one of your ABC Catalyst reports. You're in the States and you were there for a Falcon 9 rocket launch. I don't know, was it for the International Space Station payload, like tonight?
It was, yeah. It was a resupply mission, yeah.
All right. Can you just take us through
for the next... It was a Korean communication satellite launch, which is why it didn't get to land back. But yes, yeah.
All right. So if you can just take us through what that is like.
So it is a very early start. You want to beat the crowds. There's a minimum safe zone. And you want, and there are, well, thousands of people that attend these launches and try to get as close as they possibly can. And I had a director who was extraordinarily fanatical about getting the best shot for the camera. Mm-hmm. So basically from the early morning sunrise, we're camped out watching at the minimum safe distance. It's about 3 miles, about five kilometers. And you're waiting and watching as this white, fairly innocuous looking shape in the distance doesn't do a lot. And that's the key. You spend the most inordinate amount of time waiting. And the energy builds, the anxiety, the trepidation, everyone begins to get on edge. I swear, even the animals begin to behave differently. Certainly the birds get a bit freaked out. You begin to see a little bit of the steam, the condensate from the coolants or the chilled fuel is loaded and the locks. And everyone's tuned in to the live feed from the control room. And then it happens. And this flame, this glow, incredibly bright, begins. And it's silent. And the rocket rises, and it's silent. And no one's saying anything. There's just no words. In fact, I had the director screaming at me just to say anything for the show, like, mm-hmm. So some emotion. I'm just like... And then the noise hits. And, of course, it's the travel time for the sound. It takes 3 seconds each and every kilometer. So about 15 seconds. This rocket is quite some distance up by the time the sound hits. And it starts as the loudest thunder you've ever heard, and then it builds, and by the end you stop hearing it and your stomach is just vibrating in sympathy and harmonics with this thing. It is absolutely incredible. And it's at that point that you realize, as this beautiful white rocket rides a tail of flames up into the blue sky, just why engineering is so cool. It is.
Well said.
I say this as a theoretical astrophysicist, right? So, you know. And I have never been so struck by the sheer technical skill as watching something that is ostensibly 9/10 of a bomb. I mean, and that is what a rocket is. 9/10 of it is just a bomb. Launch in such a controlled manner.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's gone, and you're left with this something that had previously been on the ground. You'd sat and watched it for hours. Was now in space, and that is just an amazing feeling. And then the crowd cheers, and they would holler. And every car alarm has the shockwave has hit, so every car alarm has gone. So everything about it becomes extremely noisy all at once. But for the longest time, there's silence.
So that was going to be my next question. When can we cheer tonight?
Well, you can't cheer until this thing actually turns on, right? Like, I mean, fundamentally, it's part of the mission.
Good point.
For the rest of the people who aren't necessarily directly involved.
We've got the live feed.
Yeah, directly involved with the camera. Ignition's always a good start. Actually, though, the most dangerous moment for the rocket launch is what's called max Q. So this is where the rocket, it's about 1 minute, 1 minute 20 or so into the launch, it's constantly gaining speed, but not as quickly as it could. And that's simply because the dense atmosphere, relatively low to the ground, to the surface, presents a tremendous barrier. And you don't want to punch that any harder than you have to. So you actually don't go quite as quickly as you could so that you don't experience the maximum dynamic pressures on your spacecraft. That point, max Q, is reached a little bit after it's hit the sign barrier. Once it passes through that, it really is, relatively speaking, clean sailing. Everything gets thinner. It can begin to accelerate. The points I would begin to cheer are once it's made max Q, and then it's had MECO, main engine cutoff, SECO, which is the secondary, and you're in space. So all up, cheer absolutely after maybe, do the countdown, and then cheer about a minute and a half.
Minute and a half, okay. So synchronize your watches.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, you'll know.
After at least a minute and a half.
Yeah, you'll know because everyone at SpaceX Command just genuinely begins to shout and holler.
Ah, okay. Well, we will have the live feed. So we're looking forward to that. Now, I've just been given the signal that you probably have to get moving soon.
Oh, really? Oh, flip, okay.
If you could just give us your thoughts in relation to Australia, just having established a space agency, what we are trying to collectively do here in Victoria to be a part of that. Where do you think it's heading? Where would you like to see it going? And what advice would you give?
Okay, so the Australian Space Agency in this current incarnation is a huge deal. It is a huge deal to have the national agency, and it will have a lasting and a long-term legacy. It doesn't have enough funds to directly create projects to undertake the R&D itself. That is an opportunity for CRCs, for universities to step up. And of course, there's the SmartSat CRC involving Victoria as well as South Australia and others. And I think what Victoria can do is focus on what it does best. That's data science, data analytics, 3D printing, so additive manufacturing, all of those areas where we have specialized for other reasons that we can then redeploy and turn into aerospace. And that's what the Australian Space Agency will have to do. If it's going to be a success, it will have to see the states and territories focus on what they do best, harness that collectively, and as a nation, we move forward. Now, as someone who loves to niggle some of the other states, I do enjoy the rivalry, and I do enjoy this bidding process we're seeing at the moment to host the Space Agency. It's important where it goes. It's an important political statement. It's an important statement for the locations. But of even more importance is that it operates with that national vision, and it does seek the best technologies and skills and techniques from each of the states and territories. Some will do some things better than others. That's the nature of the business. But it has to support that, which means we probably, and this would be the one bit of advice, we probably want to see national flagship missions. The sooner the better we can actually propose a large, singular or swarm satellite that actually brings together a number of these different strengths, that will bind this nation and create a true aerospace industry in Australia.
Excellent. Well, we will probably see later a proposal we're working with Sydney University in terms of a first microsatellite. I may or may not have shown that to you before. We're going to have to wrap it up there for you.
Dr. Peter Mower of La Trobe University and Professor Alan Duffy of Swinburne University. Having seen three rocket launches myself, I can only endorse Alan's enthusiastic description of the experience. Peter Mower then went on to explain what the DSIS camera is and how it was developed.
So I'm going to quickly go through a presentation behind the background of how we became involved. The instrument itself, I won't have enough time to go into the details of it, but this has been a fair journey. So it'll be launched at 7:41. It'll take 3 days for it roughly to reach the International Space Station. It's part of an overall payload, so there are supplies there for all the astronauts and a hell of a lot of other equipment. So the DSIS instrument, the hyperspectral camera, is a part of the payload. Once it's up there, there's a robotic arm that will then take the camera out of the payload and it will install it onto a platform, which is called the MUSIS platform. There are 4 slots in it. This is the first instrument of its type to go into that platform. This is also the first experiment of its type to place this type of hyperspectral camera on the International Space Station. Traditionally, you have to build a standalone satellite, probably about the same size as this lectern, and it can cost around $100 to $200 million. The reason for trialing this camera on the International Space Station is to bring that cost down to around roughly $20 million. It'll be the first time also that after 4 years, it will then be returned back to Earth. So we'll be able to study the effects of the conditions of space on the camera itself, and we'll be involved in that as well. So the Department of Engineering at La Trobe University, what a great department. Traditionally, it's been a department of electronic engineering, highly specialised in electronics. And it's pretty much the main reason why the German Aerospace Centre found so much value in the work we do there, which I'll get to in more detail. So we do now civil engineering, industrial engineering, which is a combination of mechanical, civil and electrical. We will have electronic engineering again soon. And we've got a greater range of capabilities, key customers, key partners. So the German Aerospace Centre is the biggest space agency funded by any nation in the EU. It's the biggest participant of the European Space Agency in terms of funding and also activities. They are also NASA's largest international partner. We tend to not really hear much about them, but they are big. They have roughly around 2.5 billion euro to play with per year, 8,000 researchers, scientists, engineers employed across all those sites. We have worked mainly with the Adlers Hof team in Berlin, the optical systems team, but we're also working with Oberpfaffenhofen, and we'll be testing everyone tonight. Before you go home, you have to pronounce that correctly or else you won't get to go home. And here is HQ in Cologne. So this is their budget for their activities for Germany alone. They also contribute around 1.2 billion just to ESA. So for space research and technology, we're looking at 340 million a year. On a per capita basis, if we want to look at how much the Australian Space Agency should be funded by, we should be looking at around 150 million Australian a year. That's what I believe the Space Agency should be aiming to do in its first 4 years of its existence, is to make the business case to then ask for the serious amount of funding required to really establish a thriving space industry. There are 2 lines of instrumentation builds. This is the high spectral devices and high-resolution satellites. We've been involved in the DSIS instrument, which is going up tonight, and we've also been asked to be involved in a number of satellite builds here. These are billion-euro satellite builds, and there's many more to come. So that just is a testament to the quality of specialisation we have in the engineering department. The colleagues we're working with at the German Aerospace Centre are also building a spy satellite constellation for the German government. which is valued, I'd say, in the many, many billions of dollars. So I don't think we'll be able to be involved in that type of work. So there's a considerable amount of opportunity. When I was in Berlin last year talking with Dr. Andreas Eckhard, he ran off millions of dollars worth of projects we can be involved in. It's amazing. I wish I had a team there with me in Berlin. So just to recap the situation, yes, fantastic timing. We've just established a space agency 1st of July. We're already putting up some know-how, Australian know-how, into space. We've also got the Victorian State Government also making a play to be involved in that, in the new and thriving space industry in Australia. So
We'll hear more from Peter Mower from the Engineering Department of La Trobe University a bit later in the show.
Southern FM, the sounds of the Bayside.
At Cape Canaveral, the Falcon 9 was being fueled as the clock counted down inexorably towards launch time. Meanwhile, here in Melbourne, Peter Mower told us what the DESIS instrument is and what it will do.
The DESIS instrument, what is it? Summarise some of the general overall usages of the instrument.
The Earth is an amazing array of colours, but the human eye can only see a small portion of all the colours the Earth has to offer. Teledyne Technologies is partnering with the German Aerospace Center to bring us a more colorful view of the Earth than ever before. Occupying Teledyne's MUSES instrument slots will be DESIS, the DLR Earth Sensing Imaging Spectrometer. Precise spectral data like the kind from DESIS can have significant value for commercial and scientific applications. So whether we're mapping and monitoring forests, improving maritime domain awareness, exploring for oil and gas resources, or responding to natural disasters, Teledyne and DLR are changing the way we look at our world together.
The DESIS instrument, as we just heard in that, broadly speaking, is going to provide high-resolution imagery with about 240 spectral bands to capture imagery of the Earth's surface for a number of vital Earth monitoring applications: crop analysis, vegetation analysis, deforestation, disaster management, fires, floods, cyclones. And the unique aspect about this hyperspectral camera compared to most hyperspectral cameras that are up there at the moment is that because it's fixed to the International Space Station, it will be able to take varying angles of imagery as it's passing overhead in a manner that can't be conducted to date. And it's through that combination of varying angles with some sophisticated software, we'll be able to extract extra features and value from the imagery for end-user products. And I know there's a lot of major global organisations waiting for this instrument to operate and send data. I know we ran a summer school in February up at Sydney University. German Aerospace Centre came in. We had a number of experts in Australia that utilised the data from remote sensing satellites and these type of instruments. And the people, experts in Australia working on the Great Barrier Reef, have been waiting for this instrument for a very long time for them to be able to better analyse the effects of all the nitrates and fertilisers that we're just flushing into our oceans to be able to better gauge the state of health the Great Barrier Reef is in. The imagery would also be able to hold governments to account once they've signed up to the Paris Accord as to how they're tracking with their emissions. So a major instrument for humanity.
The technical leader on La Trobe University's DESIS team was Darrell Elton. Peter Mower asked him to describe his role in the project.
This is Darrell Elton. Big round of applause. No need to sit down. I'm going to put you on the spot, Darrell. Now, just a bit of background. Now, I did my undergraduate at La Trobe University, and Darrell taught me advanced RF electronics in my final year, right? Just an indication of how advanced he is. And it's been quite an enjoyable moment for me to come back after many years overseas, to come back into the engineering department and help set up this project. And it's pretty much Daryl's know-how that's going up there with support from the larger team. So I thought I'll put you on the spot, and if you can just explain to the audience tonight what is happening up here on the International Station, International Space Station, when it's plugged in, how is the data going to be acquired, where is it going to go, and how is it going to be beamed back down to Earth?
Oh, that's a fairly long-winded explanation, but I assume we want a short version of this. So that plus the work that our team's done. So the Germans have, well, several organisations within Germany have done combinations of optics and some fairly what you might consider rudimentary things like power supplies, which are actually fairly tricky things when you have to put up with large amounts of radiation and not frying things. So we've got the Germans taking care of what you might consider to be the environment for this to operate. And one of the toughest things to operate an instrument in space, of course, is the fact that you have to put up with extreme temperatures. So if you were to shadow something, it would plummet in temperature to, well, not absolute zero, but very cold, way colder than what you would normally have to deal with on the bench or even in the Antarctic. And then if it were exposed directly to sun, things get very hot very quickly. And, of course, you can't just put a fan on. So we've got to get rid of heat via radiation. We have to put up with cold environments, cold you can deal with in terms of things as simple as a heater. But, and this is one big plus for operating on the International Space Station, is if you want to heat something, that takes energy. And you don't have, you know, a Loyang sitting at the end of the beam. So on an International Space Station, as you can see, the biggest feature on there, of course, solar cells. That provides a reasonable power source. And one of the things that makes it a lot cheaper for our instrument, which is the size of a small portion of a minibar, the actual instrument itself, is the fact that we don't need to provide the ability for the instrument to power itself. So our power comes from the International Space Station. And that's actually part of what the Teledyne group have done. So they provide the basics of the power from within the International Space Station to our instrument. They provide a data connection. Now, Peter is asking about the data. So my involvement in the project was from the camera to getting the data which comes off the camera chip at very high speed, organising it into a particular format, storing it temporarily in memory that has to put up with radiation, which causes perhaps temporary amnesia and eventually long-term damage, which was also covered before. We get to pull this instrument apart after some years to see how badly damaged it is. So I took the data from the camera, put it in via an FPGA into some cute little gold cubes of memory, and then that has to be transported via the Teledyne Ethernet link back into the inside of the International Space Station. So that's actually not much more complicated than your little wireless at home. In fact, it's probably lower grade than the wireless you've got at home. It just happens to operate in space. So we get from the instrument the data delivered to a computer, a fairly normal sort of computer, inside the International Space Station, and then that gets prioritised as to how it gets downloaded via various links to the ground. So, again, we don't have a continuous data connection from the space station to the ground. We have variable amounts of bandwidth. So if you're above something that's got a good connection and someone wants to download a lot, then we can do that. So in other words, we don't have the ability to just simply plug in a camera, like a Wi-Fi IP camera that you might have for your home surveillance, and, you know, juice it up a bit and have a bit more bandwidth and a whole lot of spectral parts. It's a lot more complicated because there's a whole long path to get the data from the sensor chip, buffering and making sure of the data integrity at each stage, such that when it does arrive on Earth, the client has a reasonable understanding of the integrity of that data. And there's the reverse direction as well, and that's part that cost me a bit of stress as well. We have to be able to control this instrument. So, again, it's not like your IP camera where you just turn it on and you see everything. If you did that, the amount of data generated would be prohibitive to download. So we have something in the order of 200 and something wavelengths available to us, not three. We have an image that's several thousand pixels across in one go, but of course we're spinning around the Earth, well, we circle around the Earth in 90-minute rotations. So the space station goes around in 90 minutes. So if we've got a line scanner that's got all of these fancy colours in it, then it goes around the Earth and we can take rather large slabs. If we left that on continuously, we've chewed up a whole lot of our download time in a space of a few minutes. So that's why all of that buffering and the fancy electronics. Anyway, so did that in some way answer your question about how the data gets its way back?
That was Daryl Elton, the technical lead of DSIS at La Trobe University. The Falcon 9 rocket at the Cape was now almost fully tanked up with RP-1 kerosene fuel and liquid oxygen oxidizer. A stationary steam engine vents steam to prevent pressure building up too high. So too does a rocket vent oxygen as it boils in the heat of Florida. And no, that wasn't a steam engine, that was the Falcon 9 rocket. In Melbourne's northern suburb of Sydney, at Sydney University, experienced space engineer Warwick Holmes was keeping an eye on the SpaceX team. Peter Moore invited him to remember what lies behind the preparations to launch a rocket into outer space.
He studied avionics engineering at Sydney University, I guess about 35 years ago. And then he left to go to the UK, ended up working for ESA for about 30 years and worked on a major number of instrumentation projects for space, 37 tonnes in all. His major achievement before he came back to Australia was being the lead engineer for the Rosetta spacecraft mission. I think there was a 1 or 2 billion euro mission. So he was the final engineer to give the go call for the launch for the Rosetta spacecraft mission. Warwick and I, we ran a summer school with the German Aerospace Centre in Sydney. And we actually had the Defence Department partake in the summer school, and after 3 days realised they, you know, probably the world's most serious engineers were in the room, and they actually asked us to help. All right, now Warwick Holmes, thank you for joining us all the way from Sydney, Australia. How are you this evening?
I'm very good, Peter.
Thank you very much for taking the time on short notice to give us your insight as to what actually happens behind the scenes when it comes to a launch such as what's going to happen in about 15 minutes. 15 minutes? 16 minutes? We'll have a quick 10-minute chat, then with 5 minutes to arrange ourselves out the back. So how many launch campaigns have you been involved in?
Well, Peter, look, before I answer that question, I just want to congratulate you on an amazing achievement this evening to get this far. Wow. For La Trobe University and for yourselves personally. You should be extremely proud of this. This is a very complex mission. To have been involved with the German Space Agency to get to the launch day today is really a staggering achievement, and I want to congratulate you, La Trobe University, and your engineers.
Thank you, Warwick. Coming from you and considering your background, that does certainly mean a lot. So thank you for that. We don't have a lot of time. So how many launch campaigns have you been involved in?
Well, Peter, I've done 5, and that was from the Centre Spatial in Guyana for the Ariane and ESA launch program. There were 5 of them, Ariane 3, Ariane 4, Ariane 5, and 2 Soyuzes. Two Ariane 5s and a Soyuz. So I've had a lot of experience of launching rockets. The situation right now for your launch will be they've done a series of launch rehearsals in the last few weeks, and this is the real thing now. And they're doing full flight pressurization of the launch vehicle, and several hundred people are involved in these launches. A lot of them are hidden behind the scenes, which you don't see. And when you're in this kind of situation, you know, it's an accumulation of an enormous amount of fear, because nobody wants their bit to go wrong. Now, even though fear is not associated with something missing, it's just thinking, what, at the last minute, could something go wrong which they haven't seen before? So right now, everyone's on tenterhooks, and it's a very, very nervous situation for them in Cape Canaveral.
Excellent. I do remember you using more colourful language yesterday
and
some more dramatic.
In front of your audience.
Oh, I think we can manage that because... So were there any close calls that you were involved in or maybe responsible for?
Well, what actually happens is, you know, in the background, of course, is with all these launch rehearsals, what you're doing is you're fine-tuning the software so that the limits of about 50,000 different telemetry parameters, which are being simultaneously monitored, they change because of weather conditions, because of temperature and the different circumstances at the launch site. What happens is, you know, some of them pop up, which you haven't seen before, and you have to make an instantaneous decision whether it's a go or a no-go. So this is actually currently what the about 300 engineers would be involved at the moment. And they're about 200 of the 50,000 parameters will be read today, something like that. You won't hear about them because they're just being analyzed one by one. Most of them, almost all of them, are actually quite benign things, so temperatures or pressures, which are just a slightly out of calibration, and they can make an instantaneous decision. But if it's something more serious, of course, then unfortunately there'll be a launch delay.
And have you been involved in any delays? Have you seen any delays like in the last 24 hours or...?
Yes, well, for the Rosetta mission that went to land on the comet, we had four consecutive days of delays. And the last day, which was the absolute ultimate launch day, we had a six-second launch window to get Rosetta or the Ariane 5 off and to launch the mission. And luckily, we got that. So we're going to say yes no matter what happened anyway. But the point is... it was a very, very stressful situation. And really, people on the cameras, they look calm, but inside they're absolutely terrified, I can tell you.
Okay, yeah, you gave an example yesterday about the tolerances on a resistor that could be breaching certain bands. Could you just give us that example again?
Well, this is where we have, for example, I say we have these limits for monitoring these 50,000 parameters. No human can possibly simultaneously monitor 50,000 parameters, so we get the computers to do that for us with certain limits. Now, anything that goes outside the limits immediately draws our attention, and this is where, for example, you can get something quite benign, something quite trivial, like a resistor, a thermistor, in fact, for measuring a temperature, and suddenly it goes red. You get about 1,000 engineers jump onto it because they're saying, you know, when it goes red, that means something has gone seriously wrong. But in fact, it can turn out in many occasions to be just a calibration parameter which slipped through the system. So, but it's just funny to see the enormous attention that these red parameters get when they pop up for the first time. But hopefully there won't be many of those for your launch today, Peter. And I'm really wishing you all the best because this SpaceX launch is going to be really spectacular.
Thank you.
And I can imagine your DLR colleagues there in Florida right now, they're probably extremely excited.
Actually, that's a good point you make, that the German aerospace team we've been working with did message me about an hour ago to wish us luck as well with the launch. So they're pretty much all over there at the Kennedy Space Center. So those 50,000 parameters real time requiring a computer, sometimes I think my wife can do 100,000.
But Peter, these are parameters not only on the launch vehicle but on the payload itself. So I'm specifically thinking of the payload because they have to be monitoring that before the launch as well. They can abort a launch if the payload is not happy. So if DSIS, for some reason, has some irrecoverable problem, even on the day of the launch, they will actually abort the launch for the payload, which is what it's all about, of course. But I imagine DSIS is working perfectly right now.
Of course, naturally.
But Peter, what I want to ask you is, are you going to get an image of La Trobe University in hyperspectral? That's what I want to know.
Of course. We'll have 3D hyperspectral imagery of La Trobe University. I think we'll struggle to get anything for Sydney University.
I was going to say, you'd probably give me one in black and white, won't you?
if at all. It'll be of probably UNSW.
Yes. Don't mention that.
Okay. In the remaining 4 minutes, can you just quickly describe what was the trigger behind starting the Rosetta mission? That, you know, the Australian background towards why Rosetta was initiated.
Right. Well, there's a very strong connection to Victoria, in fact, for this story, because in Murchison, in Victoria, the town of Murchison was 150 kilometres north, I think, of Melbourne. There was a meteorite hit on the 28th of October in 1969. And this meteorite came in on a Sunday morning and the townspeople came out. There was an enormous bang and they actually all ran out of the church service. In fact, they were at the end of the time. And there was a very strange smell in the air. associated with this re-entering what they thought was a meteorite. Well, it was a meteorite, but it was a very, very special one in that it wasn't an asteroid, which is what 99% of meteorites are. It was the heart of an evaporated comet. And the unusual smell that they could smell was amino acids. And it turns out that in the Murchison meteorite, there are more than 100 different amino acids, of which only 20 exist on Earth. So they were smelling the chemistry of 80 amino acids which do not even exist on planet Earth. On the basis of that incredibly interesting meteorite, that was a very strong driver for the basis of the Rosetta mission, to go out to a comet directly and to try to measure and understand what is the chemistry on these very unusual bodies. But this whole story was essentially triggered to a very, very big extent by the Murchison meteorite hitting Victoria in 1969.
And you were the lead avionics engineer for the Rosetta mission? You gave the final go?
I was one of four avionics engineers on the mission. It's such a big spacecraft and so complex, they had four of them. Yes, I did give the final go at French Guiana on the Ariane 5. And it was one of the most, it was a highlight of my professional career to be associated with such an important mission. And this is why I know what the people at DLR are going through right now in Florida.
Right. Okay. Excellent, Warwick. Thank you very much for your time. A round of applause for Warwick. He'll also be watching the live feed.
As Warwick Holmes of Sydney University and Peter Mower wrapped up their conversation, we were only minutes away from liftoff. Because of the need to synchronize the launch with the orbit of the International Space Station, the SpaceX team had to light the wick within 1 second of the designated time. Miss their appointment? They would have to reschedule the launch to another date. Here in Melbourne, at the headquarters of Engineers Australia, the gathering fell silent with nervous anticipation. Would years of effort be blown to smithereens, or would they be on their way to the space station? At SpaceX headquarters in Hawthorne, California, a commentator described their Falcon 9 rocket.
The Falcon 9 flying today is a two-stage rocket. The first stage has 9 engines named Merlin. The second stage has a single Merlin engine, which can operate in the vacuum of space. The engines are fueled by RP-1, which is a rocket-grade kerosene, and liquid oxygen. RP-1 fueling of both the Falcon 9 stages began on time at T-minus 1 hour and 10 minutes. Liquid oxygen began flowing into both rocket stages as planned at T-minus 35 minutes, and teams will begin setting up for final fuel at T-minus 7 minutes.
Then came the time to light the candle.
Flight computer is making its final pre-launch checks. Propellant tanks are...
go for launch.
Flight pressure, and as you hear, launch director Mike Taylor gives a go for launch of today's SpaceX CRS-15 mission. T-minus 30 seconds.
Gas closeouts complete.
The pad deluge water system will be activated at T-minus 18 seconds.
Stage 1 tanks pressing for flight.
T-minus 15 seconds.
Everything is go.
10, 9,
T-minus 8 seconds. 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. We have ignition and liftoff. The Falcon 9 rocket powers the Dragon spacecraft toward the International Space Station, laden with new research for the multinational crew.
I have lost count of the number of times, be it on television or radio, that announcers have pronounced a successful launch as soon as the rocket has cleared the tower. That's less than 100 meters into the air. But it takes about 8.5 minutes to reach low Earth orbit. At any second during the ascent, things can go belly up. A premature engine shutdown will mean failure to reach orbit, or the satellite will end up in the wrong orbit. An engine explosion will destroy the whole vehicle and its satellite. Here in Melbourne, we all understood this. Then, 9.5 minutes after liftoff, we heard the news that we had been waiting for.
Stage 2 AFDS is saved.
Autonomous flight termination system is safe, but 15 seconds away from a second stage engine cutoff. Engine shutdown.
Nominal orbit insertion.
And as you hear, normal orbit insertion.
Acquisition of signal new for length.
Next major milestone will be the deploy of the Dragon spacecraft. And we have Dragon separation. Dragon flying DCS on its own.
Countdown, Dragon confirmed separation.
Confirmed separation as Dragon begins its journey toward the International Space Station. 1 minute away from the begin of solar array deploy. This will ensure that the Dragon spacecraft is powered for its trip to the space station. This is just the beginning of a carefully choreographed series of Draco thruster firings to reach the space station, and all that activity will be managed and monitored here at the International Space Station Flight Control Room at Mission Control Center in Houston, Texas.
This is Dragon CC on countdown. Dragon's propulsion system has successfully primed, and all thrusters report ready for firing.
Standing by for confirmation of solar array deploy.
Dragon is deploying its solar arrays.
And as you can see, the solar arrays deploying on the Dragon spacecraft. This will provide power to Dragon as it initiates its journey toward the International Space Station. 12 and a half minutes after liftoff, everything went very well. Dragon is where it belongs in space. The solar arrays locking into place.
So as Dragon unfurls its solar arrays, the spacecraft will continue its journey to the International Space Station. Dragon will arrive at the station on Monday, July 2nd.
Now, it was time to relax and enjoy the food and drinks and chat. I drew Victoria's lead scientist, Dr. Amanda Caples, aside and asked her about Victoria's bid to host the nascent Australian Space Agency. For that conversation, I invite you to tune in to next week's The Space Show here on Southern FM. That's 88.3 megahertz on the FM dial. And good news, that Dragon spacecraft has now been berthed with the International Space Station, and in due course that payload will be loaded onto the space station's facilities. I'm Andrew Rennie.
Hi, this is Mark Holden, and you're listening to 88.3 Southern FM.